No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in by calling at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us at BBS Radio 1. That's BBSRadioone. We're excited to have back again as a guest, Kathleen Gomez, and we're excited to welcome Maria back to the show because she's taken a little break and gone to some very exciting places. So it's great, and I hope people call in with your questions because we don't get the opportunity to talk to these two at the same time very often. Ladies, are you there?
We're here. Good afternoon and good evening.
Yeah.
Yes, good evening.
Well, first of all, I want credit for being brave enough to come on the air with two intelligent, articulate Latina women. I think that takes a lot of guts, but I'm happy you're here. Let me first say, in a moment of seriousness, and that unfortunately, we had a woman in that worked in our office until a month or so ago, named Haley Jardis, lovely lady, but her brother, Thomas, is one of the missing Marines off the coast of Hawaii. So I just want to say to Haley and her family that we're thinking about you and we'll keep you in our prayers. And if you're listening out there, folks, his name is he's a Marine. His name is Corporal Thomas J. Jardis. Keep him in your prayers and your thoughts. And we hope that he comes back safely. To you and your family, Haley. In addition to that, just to talk about statehood for a second, we have a new co-sponsor of our bill. She's a Latina woman. Her name is Nadia Velasquez from New York's 7th District. So we thank you, Congresswoman Velasquez, for being our latest co-sponsor.
So, Michael, since I was out of the country for the last month, would you mind updating me and the listeners about what is going on with the effort for D.C.?
Well, we've picked up two co-sponsors probably since the last time that you were on the show, Maria. And so now we're up to 129 co-sponsors in the House. We've got 19 in the United States Senate. I'm not sure if you were here when we picked up Tim Kaine from Virginia. The good news about that is that we have both senators from Maryland and one senator from Virginia, and we're working on our old friend Mark Warner. Kathleen and I used to work with Mark Warner, and if we can get him, then we would have all four senators from the two neighboring states, and very often that's an argument people put up. They say, oh, the people in Maryland and Virginia would never support you. So it looks like that's not the case. And that's the biggest happening. In addition to that, as you know, President Obama gave his State of the Union speech. And every year we ask him to mention his neighbors in the district. But every year he hasn't ever done that. So we're miffed at the president, but that's basically what's going on. We're pushing hard to get co-sponsors. And Kathleen and I'll talk about this a little bit. We're about to launch a website, Teach Democracy, which focuses, among other things, on DC webs, DC statehood as a you know, like a real-time lesson in advocacy and civil rights for students across America. This is a struggle you can get involved in. So that's what's going on. Thanks for asking. How was your vacation?
It was spectacular. It was I was mostly out of the country, and of course that always gives me such a keen appreciation for being back in our country. There's nothing like experiencing others and their challenges and their struggles and with things that we take for granted sometimes. So that's always a great civics lesson too. And it was fabulous. I had a birthday while I was gone. That was part of the reason that I was gone.
21 and, again?
I'm sorry?
21 again?
Yeah, otra vez. Cada año.
Every year, jeez.
Yes.
You should know about that, Michael Brown. Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe.
I can't even remember 21.
That's probably because you lived a good one.
You know, nice. I have to have other people tell me what 21 is. Oh, but yes, let's have a shout out to Trisha Brown, who I called the other day and she had a hangover. I do remember those. It's been a long time since, you know, but it's nice when your kid says, "I can't talk to you right now, Dad. I got a hangover."
At least she's admitting it. That's good.
Yeah, and at least she's being honest. She could have said, you know, I got a cold or something. But, well, I'm glad you had a good time. And that's absolutely the truth. Kathleen has spent a lot of time out of the country, and she can, you know, visiting other places.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is something we've talked about a lot. Yeah, with all its bumps and bruises and whatever your complaints are, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find an American that would say they wanted to live somewhere else.
True.
You know,
that
they weren't, you know, they weren't happy growing up in America.
I think that you know, it's funny because we talked about that. I always thought that everyone who's an American citizen should spend 6 weeks in a place like Mexico, or, you know, even in a place like Athens where you can't throw your, you know, when you go to the bathroom, you can't throw your tissue down the toilet. You have to put it in a bag. I mean, there are some things that, and I think especially women take for granted. American women. And, you know, I don't know. I've just got this, you know, I guess I'm getting paranoid, but I just see women across the world slowly, their rights, you know, we should be advancing more. There should be less of this, you know, whole issue of what women are doing. I mean, I just thought we'd be in a better place. And I think women need to start, you know, kind of taking their head out of the sand and at least get the ERA passed in the United States, because we're not protected by the Constitution. And I don't see a wave of women becoming more equal. I see a wave of women losing what they have, what little they have. So,
and Kathleen, to your point, a wave of women who have become complacent with the status quo.
Yeah.
I happen to be reading Gloria Steinem's autobiography at this very moment. She's 84 years old now, and boy, do we owe a lot to her and what she's done for women. And she laments that too, that it doesn't seem like there's another generation to pass that baton to.
No.
That they've gotten just, I think we might think that this is as good as it gets.
Or that it's already passed and it's just assumed that we are going to have the same rights as men do. And I don't know, you know, I talked about this last time on the show, and I think maybe a lot of people thought I was hysterical, but my son is going to Italy, and he has a fear of what the Muslims are doing in Europe, because it's changing Europe's face, you know, because there's so many of them. And then he starts to send me this stuff. And you know, it's not from American media. It's from the Croatian news, the Polish news. He's getting very involved. His father's Croatian. And he's sending me stuff from other news sources that are legitimate. I mean, one was from BBC. And, you know, it's not looking good for women in Europe.
Yeah.
And I think that we in America should really, the women should really wake up, see, and notice what's happening over in Europe right now with women. And, you know, the whole thing with Cologne. I mean, there's still stuff coming out. You don't see it in the mainstream news over here in the United States, but it's all over in German press and all that, of even how the female mayor said to the women of her town, you know, maybe you need to worry a little bit more about how you dress. Meanwhile, we'll teach these Muslim men, we'll give them a training course on our culture. And that, you know, it's okay. We allow women to dress like this or to, you know, to do things that they see as totally, you know, you can die for doing those things in their countries. And, well, you know, and I know it sounds crazy, but...
Well, the only thing I'd say about that is what I said last week, that 20 years ago, you would have been saying that in New York. You would have been saying, you would have had some woman on the phone saying, I can't walk down the street by the construction workers because all the construction workers whistle at me and say, you know, crude things and stuff.
And now we can. And so you're telling me that that's the way it's not going to revert back to that. I'm telling you that we've got to a certain place. We now, I see it. It could possibly erode very easily. And I think it's interesting as a man, a white male as yourself, saying these things because you don't experience what we do. You can stand on the street and make a joke about construction guys whistling at women, but you don't know how far. Now it is come to the point where, you know, people are saying, well, we can't blame the woman for how she dressed and why she went to a college fraternity and got raped. Well, she deserved it because she was wearing a short dress. You can't say that anymore. But now you hear the mayor of Cologne saying it in Germany. So I'm saying that's so far-fetched.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I agree that you shouldn't turn back the clock, and we should be very aware of this. The only point I was trying to make is this isn't something peculiar to Muslims. This is something peculiar to men, you know,
But they brought it into the religion, because I think the other thing too, and I may sound like I'm being anti-Muslim, but I think in anything, like when you go and Maria, you have the, I don't know if you're Mexican background or whatever, but you have a Latina background, and you know how things are different in Mexico with women. Yeah. I mean, it's not America and Mexico, a woman is still in her place, and a man may have three families, and, you know, it's very, very different. So I remember when I worked for Pat Schroeder, Gloria Steinem gave a fundraiser for Pat when she was running for president. And I was amazed. First of all, I thought she'd have a huge house. She had this tiny little apartment with a little loft for a bed. But in our conversations, she had said, you know, she says, I see your generation, and I guess I was maybe in my late 20s when I was working for Pat Schroeder, and I have some faith that you guys will carry on the torch, but I look at what's behind me, the girls behind me, I don't see any of them concerned. They just feel entitled. They just think it's going to just happen that, you know, they're going to make, I mean, we've come so far, I think that we've made it too easy for them, and they don't understand how much they have to lose.
Well, and that's partly our responsibility, because we haven't educated it. It's just like there's a new generation of younger gay men who are not concerned with protecting themselves, because their attitude is that if and when I contract it, there will be a solution available. And my older gay friends, that just incenses them, and they sit them down and they give them a history lesson and a civics lesson and, you know, the culture of what HIV and AIDS has done. And how dare you go bareback thinking that it's going to be okay eventually down the road because of medicine. So
exactly.
There's a little disconnect there too.
Yeah. And, you know, we remember in the old days when AIDS was first rearing its ugly head, and they were trying to get rid of myths like, you know, people used to say things, well, you can see it in their eyes. You can see it in people's eyes when they're sick, you know, and say things like that. So I can see why they are upset, because it was a long, hard struggle.
Absolutely.
For the gay community to come to grips with it themselves. And then to get America to come to grips with it, it had to turn into a crisis first. So, yeah, I think, you know, I got to tell you the good news, though, ladies, is that if you talk to my daughter, this is one of the most fun things about her. She'll be 23 next month. She'll tell you that the thing holding women down are, you know, white men who control the power structure and you know, take advantage of women. The thing that I always find cute about it is as soon as she's finished her speech, she then asked me for the rent money.
Yes.
But
hey, Trisha, if you're listening, I know that's not true because I know you're working now, and now you're not asking your dad for very much. So you're going to have a new example, Mr. Senator Brown.
That's true.
Well, it's funny because I took my daughter on the South American and Latin American cruise that we took, and she said to me at one point, "Mom, I had no idea that you were such a feminist." And I said, "What took you so long?" Because I noticed things that we accept as normal that aren't. That, you know, there's an inordinate amount of men in this capacity, or there's not enough women in this capacity, or, you know, what have you. And I pointed out to her, and she's, because like you were saying, Kathleen, they don't know to notice. For whatever reason,
right.
It's not on their radar. And awareness is more than half of the challenge.
Yes.
Well, exactly.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Kathleen.
When we had some junior Rotarians, you know, I used to belong to the Rotarian Club in Douglas, and we would have the girl athletes. They would send us, you know, the top tennis player, the top swimming. And I always ask them, I said, "Do you know about Title IX?
Yeah.
None of them could say a word. They had no idea what it was. I said, "You know, that was that long ago. We're talking, what, 70s, 80s? I said, "You guys wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Title IX.
Yep.
Oh, when I went to college in the 1970s, there was a big battle over the fact that Maryland had one of the worst football teams in the conference, but they spent like $3 million a year on a practice facility men's football team. But the women's swim team was one of the tops in the country, and they had to get on a bus and go somewhere to work out. In a dilapidated community pool, because the pool on campus was for exercise for the guys on the football and the basketball team.
Well,
and the women weren't allowed to use it.
Right. Well, I remember what was your options. Your options in my school was maybe tennis, but it was a cheerleader. That was the one, you know, that's what women could do. And so, you know, and then I was telling them jokingly when I was in high school, remember they didn't want you to run because if you were, you know, your female organs might, you know, jostle and you couldn't have a baby. I mean, you know, these were things that I was listening to in the 70s, and now, you know, all that's not, is ridiculous, but they don't understand that it was a long, hard fight to get them the equality in
women's
perspective. That's not there, but still.
You and I are doing a great job about giving perspective, and not that you didn't provide a lovely example, Michael, but there needs to, and maybe this is something that we should do. I remember I was a child, and I went with my mother. She went to a supply store to rent an electric hedger, and at the time, there was only three of us. I'm the oldest of four. And they wouldn't rent to her because she was a woman.
Right.
And she threw a freaking fit. That's why I remember it, because I was so embarrassed by her behavior in public. And she said, she pointed to this scrawny, skinny teenager who was probably 18, because I think you had to be 18. She said, you mean to tell me that you're going to rent to him a power saw, but you won't rent to me, a mother of three, and she points to us, because I'm a woman? And they said, that's in our insurance policy.
Yep. It wasn't such far away time that these things were said about women. And not to talk over you, Senator Brown, but I think that this is something that we have to start thinking about, women of our age, and say, you know what? I just thought we'd be so much farther along, and to think that we don't have protection under the Constitution at this point in time, and that we're so complacent about it. I think women should, and mothers should be thinking really hard about what they had to go through, and say, you know what, daughters, you need to kind of, maybe if there's a fight, this is one of the fights you need to get into, and you need to start understanding this can all go away. It's not for sure, it's not for certain, unless you get protection under the Constitution.
Well, you know, a couple of things that I would say is, first of all, I truly believe that I can't understand the way, you know, the kind of things that you have to deal with. I there may be some men out there that are sensitive enough to understand it, but yeah, I don't think men fully can grasp what women have to go through. I think of my friend Cindy. You remember Cindy. I was at a party with Cindy one night, and somebody came up to her and said, you know, one thing that I hate is I go to the newsstand and I see all these men's magazines with naked women in them, but there's none of men. There's just the Cosmopolitan or whatever it was. And Cindy looked at – and she goes, why is that? Cindy looked at her and said, because if you want to see a man naked, all you have to do is say, take your clothes off. And he will. You know, so there's a cultural difference that men really, I think, don't get.
And they don't care if they have a belly, and they don't care how they look. That's the other thing, you know. It's amazing. I mean, I always say, well, I would never get make it until I look the way I want to and all that. But men don't have that kind of inhibition or shame put on them since they were young that, you know, really you only should take off your clothes unless you look like, you know, one of the models or something like that. But yeah, it is a different, totally different attitude. Men don't have to deal with the image. They don't have to deal with all that stuff that women do, you know.
Well, that's along those lines, successful. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say along those lines. As you may know, I'm getting my master's in clinical psychology, and last semester one of my courses was about theoretical orientation, starting with Freud, and going through all the way, the schools of thought, if you will. You know, Gestalt and et cetera. So the last and final one that we discussed was feminism as the therapy. It's the only one that was created by a non-white male, by the way. And it's not just about women. It's about empowering men to get out of the power struggle. It's about allowing men to have feelings. It's about allowing men to know that they also have choices in life. They don't have to default to being the breadwinner, et cetera, et cetera. It's very egalitarian. And the therapist and the client are on equal playing fields. There's no power struggle at all whatsoever. And in fact, the expert in the room is the client. So it's an amazing school of thought, and it's definitely going to inform my orientation as a therapist with my clients because of its, you know, inclusiveness.
Well,
right.
You know,
I
always thought that was a mistake too, Maria, with the women's movement of the 1970s that I was involved in, that they only talked to women, and I thought they should talk to men. Not they talked to men in the sense that men should support women because it was the right thing to do. But I always thought they should be more practical and say, look, if you're going to be married and you're married to a woman that's making 60 cents on the dollar, then your family is losing that money. It's not
good
just
point.
Her. It's you losing that money, too. It doesn't make any sense for you to go out and marry a woman with a college education who doesn't make as much as a guy with a high school education. And that's the way it was in those days. The average man with a high school education made as much as a woman with a college education. So I always thought they should have taken that approach, that you got a stake in the game, you know?
That's the truth, isn't it? Not to mention if you have a daughter, you know, let alone a mother and a sister and whatever.
Absolutely.
It affects everybody.
Yes, it does. And that, even more than men, I think, because women are so central to the family unit that which affects women affects everybody in the family. There's a lot of things that affect men that don't affect everybody in the family. But I think anything that affects a woman because she's a mother and a wife and a, you know, is really the center of a family, it affects everybody.
That's lovely to hear you say that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I grew up with a mom who I was raised by a single mom who didn't make as much money. And, you know, we were always broke as kids, you know, and part of it was my mom had good jobs, but she didn't get paid very much. You know, it's terrible to see that happen.
I wanted to ask what you guys thought of this. I was on social media or something, and I saw this kind of ad that I think actually might have been from Teach Democracy. I'm not sure. But about the whole issue, you know, my son said to me one day, he says, you know, you're not a Mexican-American, you're an American. And I said, well, yeah, I'm an American, but I've always used the Mexican-American because I grew up on the border and I always felt, you know, very much that it was part of my growing up and my culture. He says, yeah, but would you want to go back to Mexico? I said, as a woman, no, probably not. And he goes, then why do you call yourself a Mexican American? And I saw this ad, you know, where it says we're not Irish, we're not gay Americans, we're not, you know, Mexican Americans, we're not Polish Americans, we're Americans. And I just kind of made me think, do you feel that maybe all that, like, you know, African American, Hispanic American, and so that it puts us into these boxes that make us react in certain ways?
Well, I don't know about that, but I think it is a reflection of what our country was, 75 years ago, 100 years ago, where people were trying to hang on to their identity. And I remember as a kid, I grew up in a kind of an ethnic neighborhood, and it bothered me. My father was English. My mother was first generation Italian American. And it bothered me that all my friends had this identity of being Italian, except for me. You know, because even though my mom was Italian, my name was Michael Brown. I had blue eyes, blonde hair, you know, and I desperately wanted to be Italian. I often tell people I was the only kid in my neighborhood in the third grade that didn't shave, you know, and that includes some of the girls, I think, but it bothered me, you know. So when I went through my confirmation, you know, which is something I think happens at 7 or 8 years old, you choose a patron saint. And I chose Saint Dominic because he was Italian and he was young. And my mother maybe choose Saint Anthony because when I was born, she promised Saint Anthony that he would be my patron saint. And I remember my brother coming to me and saying, Michael, Anthony is very Italian. Tony, think of it. Tony, how many Tonys do you know? And so I used to call him Saint Tony. And it would drive my mother out of her mind. She'd go, he's not one of your friends out on the playground. He's a saint. He's Saint Anthony.
He's
not the tiger on the cereal box. He's a saint. So, so I remember. And I think we all wanted that. We all wanted that ethnic identity. It would be nice if we could all say we're Americans.
Because I was trying to get American. Divisive, though, Kathleen, to your question. I don't. I think it gives people a sense of belonging. But I can see how it could divide, but I don't, because it's always with the American, because I identify as a Hispanic American.
Mm-hmm.
So, because the Sanchez is from Spain.
Right.
And it just makes me feel like I'm in my hood, if you will, emotionally,
right.
But not necessarily like defensively or territorially.
It was interesting because his dad is Croatian. He's not an American citizen, but, you know, he couldn't understand why I clung to being a Mexican American. And I remember my grandmother being very, very happy when I was her first granddaughter and I was blue-eyed and very light-skinned because she felt that that was a path to freedom and that there wouldn't be the chains that tied her as a very Mexican looking woman and being grown in a Mexican culture. She felt that she had actually fulfilled this kind of American dream that her granddaughter could do anything she wanted. She didn't want me to learn Spanish at all.
Same.
You know, and she said, you can assimilate and you won't be looked at differently. And I was trying to explain that to him and I thought, well, maybe this is now a generation thing because he doesn't like that. He thinks that that's terrible. He's 21 years old. He says, you know, and he's Republican in the Republican Party. But he said to me, I have a real problem with that because you're not, you're an American. And I can understand his viewpoint. And he started to say to me, you know, you got a Muslim American, everyone else is something other before an American. And he goes, and maybe that's why we're having the problems we do, because they don't think of themselves as Americans first, but in all these other special interest groups. And so I was just wondering what your take was on it, because I know what I feel. I'm proud of that. My problem is I think I want people to know that I belong to some kind of specific interest group because I don't want to be seen as just another, you know, white person, which is kind of very strange. So I think, you know, he might be listening, but it was a very interesting conversation. And in many ways, I think he's right. I should think of myself as an American first with Mexican, you know, culture or heritage or traditions. But I have always kind of thought of it the other way. So it was interesting. And in this thinking of what's going on in the United States, you know, everyone now seems to hyphenate. They say who they are, and then it's an American. So I was just wondering if anyone thought that that was an interesting kind of aspect.
Well, you know, my grandmother, Kathleen, it's funny. Maybe it is a generational thing because I feel the same way you and Maria feel. You know, I wanted to belong to something. But my grandmother, who was blonde hair and blue-eyed, because even though she was Italian, she was born in the Alps, very close to Switzerland. Mm. She looks more Swiss than she looks Italian. She not only she wouldn't even speak Italian. She wouldn't speak Italian to you in an Italian neighborhood unless she was convinced that you couldn't communicate in English.
Right.
And my grandfather, who was an uneducated carpenter, he was a cabinet maker, but as a boy he had to travel all over Europe. He spoke French, Italian, German. The only language that he really, really never got much of a hang of was English. And I remember as a little kid, my grandmother saying to him, "Speak English, I'm an American. I don't understand." Anytime she wanted to piss him off.
Right.
"I don't understand what you're saying. I'm American. Speak to me in English." Yeah.
And it's funny that we have this multicultural experience that we're sharing because both of my parents speak English as their second language, and English was only spoken in our home because we are American, and that's
yeah.
what Americans do. And they almost wanted to shy away from their European roots because they considered themselves Americans first.
Yeah.
They were
yeah.
both born in the United States, though, so they were Americans. So, but my dad's folks immigrated through Ellis Island.
Wow. Yeah.
My
and they changed both
too.
Of their names, just like they said that they.
my grandparents too. They were Frank and Rose, and people used to say to my grandmother all the time, "Don't you mean Rosa?" And she'd go, "No, I mean Rose." You know, she was.
Yeah,
adamant.
My grandmother was Maria, and they changed it to Marie, and she kept that the rest of her
God.
Life.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
And I was like, "But that wasn't your name." She goes, "That's what they gave me. That's what I am. I'm Marie."
Yeah. Oh yeah. It is interesting. So I was just thinking, it is strange that we have those similarities. And then it would be interesting to think, what does Tricia think of herself, Senator Brown? I mean, does she think of herself as Italian or does
no,
she think?
No. I
American,
think,
right?
I think she would agree with Diego. Yeah, she doesn't. I think she sees it in other people. I think she still sees African Americans as having, you know, a distinct set of cultural grievances, really, above everything else. It's not so much that they're culturally different, but they have a different experience, and I think that registers with her. But no, I think she'd say, "I'm a white girl," if you asked her ethnicity, but she would say, "I'm American." Yeah, I'm, I don't think they see it the same way that we do. But, right. you know, now where did you grow up, Maria? Did you grow up in an ethnic, like, an environment which was segregated ethnically?
Not at all. It was the last bastion of white-collar white folks in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles.
Uh-huh. Mm.
So there was, I didn't see anybody that, I mean, because my mother's family is from northern Spain, just like you were talking, Michael, about your grandmother. I have a brother, Carlos, who's 6'3", blonde hair and blue eyes.
Yeah.
And people used to say when we were growing up, "You don't look Mexican." And we would say, "That's because we're not."
Yeah.
But what's with the Maria and the Carlos? It's like, well.
Well, and that was a big thing with my grandmother. I'm sure Kathleen could tell us that this is true, and you could tell us that this is true in your ethnic group as well. But my grandmother was Northern Italian. The Sicilians, they were the mafia and the bad people.
Or people from Naples.
Yes, but the people from Northern Italy, they were the popes and the great people of the world. And, you know, yeah. Oh, my God, help you if you suggested that she was Sicilian or from Southern Illinois.
Yeah, yeah. My mom the same way. I am not Mexican. I am Spanish.
Yeah.
Like, Mom, they're not insulting you. And she was like, they're not getting it either.
Like, yeah.
Okay, right. Never mind.
That was a big thing. And, you know, and the I tell people very often, you know, one of the best pieces of news I have is that when my son was 12 years old and was playing soccer, or 11 years old maybe, he told me about this great goal this guy made on his soccer team. And he said that this guy Timmy had made the goal. And well, there's a black guy named Tim and a white guy named Tim on his team. So I said, was it black Timmy or white Timmy? And he thought for a second. He goes, I don't know what color he is. But, you know, and I thought, how could that be? That's the first thing we all noticed about. First, you notice what sex somebody was and as a kid. And then you notice what ethnic group they belong to. You know, you're either a girl or a boy, or you're black or white or Latino or whatever. And, you know, and I just say, well, that's really nice, right, that he has to really think about it. You know, right off the top of his head, he can't remember what ethnic person was.
I have a similar story of the innocence of the young. I was dating this man who was of color, and his wife was white, and he went to pick up his son from kindergarten. And the next day, when the son came home from school, he says, Daddy, everybody says you're black. Are you?
Oh.
Yeah.
He didn't know what that meant.
Yeah.
I have a story where I went to kindergarten, and you know, at that time, my mother is from Missouri, white, you know, French and Irish, and it was a really big deal, you know, back then to have an Anglo marry a Mexican. And so my dad comes back from dental school with this Anglo and all that, and I'm going to kindergarten, and I come home, and I go to the bathroom, and I'm just scrubbing myself, and my mom says, what's wrong? I said, I'm trying to get, they call me a dirty Mexican. And so I thought it meant like I was dirty, that I had, you know, and so I was trying to wash it. So I don't know what they mean, because they keep on calling me a dirty Mexican. And then she sat me down and explained to me what it was about. But, you know, that was just, you know, kind of what people grew up with, you know, back in that day. When, you know, when you think in the 50s that somebody marrying a Mexican would be considered an interracial marriage and a really terrible, and look that how far we've come in that aspect now. It's not such a big deal,
right?
Yeah, but my mother would have put herself into a self-induced coma. I was going to marry a non-Catholic.
I mean, yes. Oh, I told my oh yeah.
That my brother, who's the most wonderful guy in the world, you know him, Kathleen.
Yes.
He still every once in a while says, when are you going to get your kids out of that cult religion? Because we practiced the Episcopal faith for a while, you know. I said, well, it's been around for 400 years, Paul. I don't think it's a cult religion. But, you know, that was it, man. And right. Everybody in my neighborhood was a Catholic. There
yes.
was Spanish, Irish, Italian, German. There were several different ethnic groups, but the one thing they all had in common is they were all Catholics.
Yeah, that was my experience.
Well, I remember you couldn't – my mother was – her brothers were very big in the Masons and Eastern Star, whatever. And so there was a Job's Daughters, which I really wanted to belong to. But, you know, and you had to have that – they didn't allow Mexicans, number one. But the other thing they didn't allow were Catholics, because they said, you're going to go and you're going to tell all the rituals and confess it to your priest, and this is a secret society. And I said, God, I don't even, you know, I didn't go to the confession that much, but they kept it. But there were a lot of reasons why I couldn't. Number one was that my dad was Mexican, but two was that we were Catholic. So it's interesting how now none of that seems to be much of an issue. Except maybe if you're Mormon, I guess, in the point with Mitt Romney. But let me ask you, Maria, as a Republican, what have you thought? What did you think of the last debates in the Republican Party, which drew a lot of people? I think over 16 million viewers watched the Republican debate the other night.
And I was otherwise occupied. I think I was in class in school. I couldn't, because I'm going to class three nights a week this semester. What I love about it is that it's generating interest. What I hate about it is the circus aspect. So yeah. it's kind of a sharp-edged sword there for me in that regard.
Yeah.
Kathleen was talking to me about how many more people are watching the Republican debates, and I think, unfortunately, that may be because of the circus atmosphere, because the Democratic debates are on tonight,
right?
And you know, the Democrats are just boring.
I mean, yes,
are they not? I mean, I like Bernie, but they're kind of boring, and I think this is one of the reasons. I actually was at a luncheon with O'Malley a couple of years ago, and he's just the nicest man, but they're boring. They want to go right to sleep. It's like going to political science, your political science 204 class.
People don't like Bernie. Ben Carson, because he's not that animated, and he is soft spoken, and he is even-keeled. And to me, it's like a physician. I do not hire any physician for their personality. I hire them for their acumen. And so I'm not one of those folks that I need that. I don't need charisma. I need leadership, and I don't need you to be bigger than life. I need you to pay attention to life. So I have an issue with folks who say, oh, he's not this, he's not that. It's like, yeah, but he's really wickedly smart.
He is very smart.
That's our pediatrician. We have a pediatrician that we've used for years who has the worst bedside manner, but he's a really good doctor. And lo and behold, his daughter graduates from medical school and goes into practice with him. And his daughter is beautiful and charming and sweet and funny. She's like everything he's not. So when my kids go to the pediatricians, and we go in to see doctor, they go, beautiful doctor or old grumpy doctor? We go, no, not beautiful doctor Nadine, the grumpy dad, but he's a really good doctor.
Yeah, really, that's my pediatrician
I think the best guy that night was Kasich, because he did seem to answer things, and I actually liked him a lot more. He seemed to answer questions about what he would do. I mean, they were all blaming, talking about Hillary Clinton and all, talking about how it's so important not to, not to vote Democratic in the next time around. But there were a few, Trump, again, still held his own, and he did pretty well. Cruz, to me, seemed, I kind of like him, but there was, between Rubio and Cruz, Rubio was really trying really too hard, I think, to put himself in there. And for some reason, I used to love Christie until he did the whole thing with the bridge. And then, I don't know, I just can't trust somebody who would be,
that vindictive. Do you think that's really true?
I think his staff did it. I think it's true.
Probably.
But I don't know. Because Kathleen and I both worked at the level that you need to work at to accomplish something like that. And we certainly... Or our bosses would have been the people that accomplished it. And we've certainly known people that, vindictive.
We've also had bosses who would say, okay, I just don't want to know about it. Go ahead.
Right.
Right? Okay, I'm going to say if I get caught that I didn't know about it, but I know about it and go ahead. So to do that, kind of pull that off, you had to have a lot of people in very high places, doing it. It's not
coordinated.
To coordinate.
And you know what? I mean, the thing is that it was so dangerous. And so, when I worked at the DNC, when Kathleen and I worked at DNC, we played pranks on the Republicans all the time and vice versa. But they were stupid little things, when you get business reply mail, you pay for it. When it's delivered to you, the recipient pays for it. So the Republicans would take and they would put a business reply envelope on 10 old phone books. So the post office would come to us and say, this will cost you $57.50. you know, and we would refuse it, and they would throw it in the trash. But we used to do stuff like that. But we didn't go down, you know, closing down Main.
Washington Bridge is a big one. But I remember when I first saw Trump and when he said the things, I said, oh my gosh, there's no way anyone could give him credit. And now, even now myself, I find him intriguing. And you know, I know I say this to you, Senator Brown, and it drives you crazy, but maybe that's what D.C. needs. Maybe D.C. needs someone. Remember when Carter came in and he didn't play the role? You know, and everyone said, well, he was just a normal guy, and that's what did him in. He didn't know how to play the game in D.C., and none of his people that came that really did either. But this guy, Trump, knows how the whole thing works. He's used both Democrats and Republicans to get whatever he wanted. He knows how the system plays, and I don't know. What do you think of Trump, Maria? I'm curious.
You know, I'm intrigued by him because of his owing no one any favors, if that's proper grammar there. So pardon me if it's not. That's what I find most attractive about him, is that he doesn't have to worry about the quid pro quo and scratching backs and lobbying and all that sort of thing, which gives him a lot of independence to make probably better positions or decisions. Mm-hmm. But I'm also concerned that he is not as much of a collaborator as we might need. And will he listen to his cabinet, and will he listen to his advisors, or will he always think that he knows best? That's my one hesitation, really, with him.
Yeah, you're right. That's true.
Because it's hard to argue with success.
Yes.
Well, and you know what? I think that he and Bernie Sanders, I've said this before, I think they're opposite sides of the same coin. I think there's people that are seriously disappointed on the way our government works and on the gridlock. And I think that, you know, people are supporting Trump for the reasons that you said, Maria, that he's not beholden to anybody, that he's outside the box, that he's not part of the system. And even though Bernie is part of the system, he also shares a lot of those qualities where he's not afraid to say what's on his mind, whether it's the right thing or not. And he's, he's not the inside guy, really. He's kind of the outlier, much like Trump. And I think the big mistake that the Republicans are making, and I think the Democrats are making it too, is they're not asking the right question. And the right question, I'll frame it, the Republicans, I see this much more clearly, should be asking, why are 35% of the people in our party supporting this guy? Not, let's get rid of the guy, or let's figure out a way around the guy. Let's figure out what the problem is. Why do people, why is he so attractive? Because I think it'll be a terrible thing if he does not get the Republican nomination and the Republicans who support him, the 35%, stay home on election day. That would be the worst thing that could happen to the Republicans. And the Democrats have to think about it too.
That's true.
Yeah,
that is
true. He'll lose all sorts of races. That's what happened with us with Carter. Remember, Kathleen? Everybody talks about what a resounding victory Ronald Reagan had. And he did, in the sense that he won. He won like 48 states, but he didn't win by a large margin.
Popular vote. This is the other big thing too, which I just think that the Electoral College thing is just sham, because they were even in many ways, but he just edged Jimmy Carter out, so he won all the states within what was like in the first couple of hours. But
he won all in the end. I think we only won two states. I mean, he won resoundingly, but it wasn't a big, and he won the popular vote as well. But he didn't win nearly as much in the popular vote. And I think a lot of that was because Democrats were disappointed with him and they stayed home.
Right.
They didn't vote.
Yeah, me, though, that's another point that Gloria Steinem makes in her book. I'm getting towards the end. She is going into the political campaigns that she worked with and for and et cetera. And she said, but the biggest mistake that anybody can make, and I believe this with all my heart, is not voting. Right. I don't really care what your opinion is if you follow up with your vote. But if you don't vote, then you don't have any opportunity, in my mind, to be a part of the process.
Right.
And I don't even want to know what your opinion is. If you don't have the decency to at least vote, then shut up.
Right. And that's another thing. I don't know about your mother, Maria, but my or yours, Kathleen, but my mother and my grandmother voted in every election. They really didn't see it as, you know, like something that they had an option to do. They thought, you know, it was something they, you know, they had to do, you know,
well,
because they had the right to do it.
If you think of it, back in their home countries, like, they wouldn't be voting anyway. They wouldn't have a vote. They wouldn't have any input. And so that's what made them want to come to – I mean, that was part of the American dream, was you were an American and you could do these things that nowhere else you could. And, I mean, to me, I think the biggest problem is we should make – forget – I'm sorry, I said this before to the Italians – Columbus Day. Or if you got to take one of these holidays away, I mean, I think we should make Election Day – a holiday so that everyone goes and votes. And if you don't vote, you get fined or something, because and the voter and doing it on computer and by absentee ballot, I don't think that that's the way either, because there's just too much fraud. But when we sit here and talk about how the soldier, and we every it's amazing now, everywhere you go, whether it's the airport, whether it's in a restaurant, wherever, everyone is thanking the soldiers, our military, for what they do. But they don't take it enough to realize that the reason they're over there is to protect the freedom that we have, and one of our biggest freedoms is the right to vote. And it amazes me that we all say we have to honor and thank them, but if you want to really honor them, then you go and vote. That's how you honor the military, who lose all the personnel who lose their lives over there, because that's what they're fighting for.
That's really, really well said. And I
except
love
the
day
the
off, too.
Columbus.
Yeah. What? Except for Columbus?
Yeah, look, Columbus did the greatest thing that's ever happened in the history of mankind. You know what he did? He took it out of all of her jewelry so that he could buy a boat. And let me tell you, I try that every year with Mrs. Brown, and it's never worked for me. So he's a man that has a lot of respect. No, I get it. Election Day should be a holiday. I mean, I remember standing out in front of the polling place the first time I ran, Kathleen. You worked the polls for me, too.
Yes.
I remember standing out in front of the elementary school, and it was the elementary school where most people in D.C. vote. It was the largest precinct. So there were all these kids just scared to death because there were hundreds of people standing in front of the school shouting, you know, vote for me, vote for Joe, vote for Susie, whoever. And these kids were just, and I'm like, they're not getting any work done anyway. Keep them home and make it a holiday, and, you know.
Yeah, the best thing about that is I had my PTA, I had our PTA fundraisers, where we held them on the day they voted at our school, and we made so much money.
Because
we had we made the most money we ever made was when we would open up in time for the voting and have coffee and donuts. Oh, my gosh.
How smart was that?
Yeah.
I tell you, we made buku bucks. It was great. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm just so saddened because I don't see the young going to maybe even vote.
Yeah.
And that scares me because if
that's going to be Bernie's problem.
If they don't turn out to vote.
Bernie, my daughter loves Bernie and the girls, you know. But Trisha, who's still registered to vote in D.C., will have to get an absentee ballot. You know what I mean? And she's 23, and she'll mean to get the absentee ballot, but then, you know, she had a hip-hop gig she had to go to, and then, you know... You know what I mean? And she'll be like, damn, you have to do it 30 days in advance. Well, look, I see that we have 3 minutes left, and I just want to end the show and say thank you to Kathleen for helping fill in while my gracious co-host was out of the country, because nobody wants to listen just to me. So thanks. And we're going to leave. We're going to play you out with a song by Stevie Wonder, because I don't want anybody to forget that tomorrow.
You're all in the keys. More music that's more like, no, today, and this all stuff. Maria, I feel so sorry for you. You've got to step in and control the music selection.
Boogie and the Bunny Man didn't write a tribute to Dr. King.
Sugar lips, sugar kisses. That's better than what Stevie Wonder.
I want to leave you with these words from Martin Luther King, and I hope you all enjoy your holiday tomorrow. But Dr. King said, commit yourself to the noble struggle for equal rights. You will make a greater person of yourself, a greater nation of your country, and a finer world to live in. And that's what we're all about in D.C. We're trying to get equal rights. And so I hope you all enjoy your Martin Luther King Day. Thank you so much, Maria, and I will see you next week, hopefully yes, with some exciting guests, more exciting guests. and Kathleen Gomez will be back in the future, I'm sure.
Yes.
And we look forward to that. Thanks, everybody. See you
Thank
next
you.
Week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.